KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM, and on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is listener-sponsored. That's right, 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. You can always make a donation to help keep KBOO organic, independent, and non-commercial at kboo.fm/give. But right now, during our fall membership drive, is the perfect time to contribute. Give now and help us reach our goal of $55,000 by October 28th. Plant seeds in your community by making your tax-deductible donation at kboo.fm/give today.
Can't get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
You can follow KBOO on all your social media platforms. Just look for KBOO on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube. Get access to our new content and news, as well as special offers and contests. Like and share your favorite community radio station, KBOO.
I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM.
Welcome to Let's Talk About Race, an intergenerational discussion about race, with independent journalists from the Pacific Northwest. From Grassroots News Northwest, I'm your host and moderator, Lenita Duke.
Hi, I'm Althea Billings. I'm a journalist and radio producer in Portland, Oregon, and I'm Generation Z.
Greetings. I am Professor Johnson, political analyst and educator, and baby boomer from the Lone Star State, Texas.
I am Cecil Charles Prescott. I host a talk show in Portland, Oregon, and I am a baby boomer.
I'm Nia Gray, the faith reporter from Pennsylvania, and I'm Generation X.
Hello, my name is Mary Lee, and I live in Portland, Oregon, and I work for The Mill, the Multnomah Idea Lab.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby, let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
This is LTAR Let's Talk About Race. I'm Althea Billings. This is our summer recap show for 2023, Drinking Through a Fire Hose. It's been a busy summer, and our panelists are here to recap and digest everything from former President Trump's multiple indictments, climate change-induced weather events, and unions on strike across the U.S. Let's jump in. We're here with the panelists recapping the summer of 2023. And with our theme for the day, 2023, drinking through a fire hose. That's kind of what the news consumption has felt like. Not always the common thing, especially looking back at August in an off election year like we are. But I want to ask our panelists our first question here, which is, what was your most important story for 2023? Let's start with Cecil.
Hello. You know, for me, I think for not only those who are living in my community, but certainly throughout the world, the most important thing, news story, has been the climate collapse all throughout the world and how governments and nations are struggling to address the needs. And more importantly, how we seem to continue to be in denial in spite of the clear evidence of the climate continually being destroyed. And we see it in wildfires and floods and earthquakes and the apocalypse that we are living in. So for me, that's the most important story of this summer.
Thank you, Cecil. Let's go to Professor Johnson next. What was your most important story of the summer of 2023?
Well, I selected the same story as Cecil,
and that is climate change. I'm down here in the South. We've been burning up this entire summer. And actually, we're just getting in the low 90s now. We're still warm down here. We're definitely seeing the impact of global warming. I just don't see how anyone can be in denial about it anymore. With the Canadian fires, if you've seen any of the photos of New York, it looks apocalyptic. You can barely see the skyscrapers on their skyline. And in Washington, they're suffering from smoke also from Canada. I think Canada's got over 450 different fires burning right now. Globally, the hottest days in July in the world, July 4th, 5th, and 6th. So it's not just the United States. And I think the larger the geographic area is, the more evidence that this is global warming. I also just wanted to mention the coral reef and the algae, that symbiotic relationship between the algae and the coral. And now we're having, you know, sort of massive coral bleaching along the coral reef where they no longer have color because they're letting go of the algae. And that has to do with the warmer temperatures. Some predictions are that we may just not have a coral reef, you know, in 50 years or so, if we don't figure out a way to stop the progression of this bleaching. I thought, just looking at all these different events, I just don't think we can afford to be in denial anymore. And I do think that this summer has certainly caught people's attention.
Thank you, Professor Johnson. Let's move over to Mary. What was your most important story of the summer of 2023?
Thank you. I appreciate my two colleagues taking a much bigger global approach to this question. I went hyper-local and hyper-focused to the city of Portland, and my response to this is the amazing work that is being done as the result of community activists and organizing to remake and recreate the city of Portland's governance structures. And this is, hundreds-year-old institutions that were created by, for, and white men and have largely continued to exist and operate in those paradigms for the benefit of white men and some white women. And through incredible activism and organizing, predominantly from communities of color here in Portland, they created a new structure. They proposed the details of how this would work. And then they ran a successful campaign to get it voted in by the community. You know, are there critical criticisms of what's going to happen? Do people not know every detail? Is there anxiety? Of course. And yet the monumental impact of what potentially is about to happen as a result of committed people deciding that something had to be different and pushing it through with intention and focus and intensity is going to result in new governance, new access, and frankly, a remaking of our democratic structures here in Portland related to city government and governance. And I, for one, think it's seismic. I think it's way overdue. I thank and appreciate all the activists that have been working for months and months and months since the bill was passed or the ballot measure was passed. And we're looking for implementation in 2024 and 2025. I just can't wait. Very hyper locally, we are having this experience. And I think there are lessons to be learned here. We've talked a lot over our conversations about how do we figure out to show up differently or to reclaim public space and processes. This is an example of a very successful movement that did happen that I think we should look at and learn from and apply to other issues and areas with which we are concerned, because I think it is a great victory for progressive people, for the community, for progressive work.
Wonderful. Thank you, Mary. Well, if I can impose upon you all, I certainly agree with what my fellow panelists here have stated as their most important story from the summer. Definitely the Maui wildfires, a hurricane in California, all of these things were extremely shocking climate change charged events that really can't be ignored. So I think that is definitely one of my top headlines. I'm going to make the case that the Georgia RICO charges against former President Trump are also important. I was wondering if somebody was going to pick it up, but I'm happy to speak about it. You know, it is the fourth set of charges he's facing, and I think that it is certainly the most consequential. So, like, when all of this happened, right, it felt like there needed to be consequences right away. The Capitol attack, this, you know, organized criminal plan to trample democracy, essentially. And I remember feeling out of sorts, I suppose, that things hadn't moved or that this continued to be talked about in a way that was like, no, yeah, this was cool. And everybody who didn't go along with it was actually the wrong ones. You know, seeing this long and hard won work that the DA in Georgia has put in to put together these RICO charges, this comprehensive, you haven't read the indictment, it is juicy, I'll tell you what. Considering it as organized crime, this indictment is able to tie together all of these disparate issues that individuals on their own may not be able to stand up to being criminally liable for them. And understanding them in that framework, I think, is really telling, because so much of the narrative up until this point has been circled on, well, oh, so the president can't call people in Georgia. That's not what's going to be litigated here. And it isn't going to be kicked down the line for forever. I mean, perhaps, you know, appeals and such might continue. But this is something that we are going to see go to trial, that we are going to see be hashed out in the public space in a way that I think may be more impactful than the other charges that he's facing, not to totally discredit those, but these are state charges. And what a lot of folks have pointed out is that, say that President Trump or former President Trump gets elected again, he can't pardon himself for state level charges. And this idea of federalism and states having their own rights is something that prevents that. So I think that was one of my important stories. There were aspects of this indictment that I missed somehow. I didn't know that they were hacking into voting machines and impersonating people. I don't know how I missed that part, but wow. It's one of those things where I feel like I can't wait for the documentary where they reenact it. Oh, additional summer milestones.
Go ahead. There are a couple of other things that happened. The Supreme Court gave us a shock. First, Roe versus Wade, but then the voters' rights in Alabama, that case. So there's some things going on with the Supreme Court that are certainly noteworthy for the summer.
It's been interesting to me to see how the right just whipsaws back and forth depending on which argument supports their position and point of view. So, you know, we hear a lot about states' rights, the overarching reach of the federal government, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have a situation where the state, you know, either itself or the overreaching on says, you know, states have got to be held accountable. And then it's back to either we look to the federal government, Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court, we use that argument. And what was the original intent of those who framed the Constitution? When it doesn't go their way, then there are states' rights. You can't tell me what to do. You're not the boss of me. And it's interesting on whatever issue, you know, the two that you just made, where the radical right comes down. And, you know, we've talked a lot about what are our challenges. No one's batting an eyelash about that. They don't consider themselves to have been inconsistent. They don't consider themselves to perhaps be weakening their position or their integrity of their stance or, you know, approach or analysis. It's simply whatever needs to be happened, whatever needs to be done to achieve the ends that they seek is what shall be done. And while I don't advocate for us as, you know, progressives or whoever, quote unquote, we are, we got to look at that and take some lessons about that. While we're considering continuing to litmus test ourselves, there's other work that's moving forward that actually is achieving the ends that we hoped we could be achieving. And I think we need to wrestle with that a little bit. So I appreciate you raising it, Professor Johnson.
We have to talk about unions.
Yes.
Such a big union summer. The WGA is on strike. SAG-AFTRA went on strike. We're now speaking, you know, in September, the UAW has gone on strike. LA hotel workers have been on strike. We've got nurses and healthcare workers edging towards the line. Teachers on strike. It's a strike summer. I love a strike summer. we're pleased to see it, especially the way that public perception has shifted, especially with the Hollywood strikes, I think, because they get a lot of attention. And there's very visible ways in which people are either complying with the strike or they're scabbing in opposition to it. But I think that it has changed the conversation somewhat for the average person that, you know, by the numbers is not in a union, maybe doesn't even know anybody that's in a union by them, to see what it looks like, what solidarity looks like, what asking for extremely reasonable and decent things for a worker might look like. And then now I'm speaking a little bit about September, but what the UAW is asking for, which is a 40% raise, really taking aim at those corporate profits. It's not just, you know, the way that the WGA and SAG have framed things, which is the very bare minimum that you certainly can spare, we just need to stay alive. It's instead looking at, well, yes, we want to stay alive. Yes, we want to be able to thrive in these jobs that continue to support us and our families and our towns, but also looking at all of the excess profit that has been made off of these workers' backs as essential workers and saying we deserve a piece of that. That is not something that just gets to go into the CEO's bonus every Christmas or whatever.
This is Let's Talk About Race, an award-winning, progressive, intergenerational roundtable of journalists from around the country. We go deep on current events and the role that race plays in our world today. Our show is hosted by Lenita Duke, the award-winning producer of Grassroots News Northwest. Our panel includes Professor Diane Johnson, journalist Althea Billings, talk show host and Reverend Cecil Prescott, and host of The Faith Report, Nia Gray, and proud bureaucrat, Mary Lee. This is Let's Talk About Race.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things. Talk about things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
So let us move on to our next segment, Hope is a Thing with Feathers. Why don't we start here with Professor Johnson? Professor Johnson, what did you select to share with us?
My hope with a thing with feathers is Coco Gauff and winning the U.S. Open. So it was very exciting to see that happen and to see the impact that's being made on women's tennis. So that is my hope is a thing with feathers. Tennis is starting to really open up. It wasn't a sport that was very welcoming to you know, to people of color. But all of that is changing, and I just applaud her magnificent performance and can't wait to see what she does next.
Let's go to Cecil. What did you select?
You know, I selected something that was very, very personal to me. This summer, I had the opportunity to go back to my high school for a reunion. I went to a New England prep school, and I'll just leave it at that. And so some of my concerns were, would people revert back to their high school roles? You know, the jocks and the cheerleaders and the nerds. So I was somewhat worried about going back. What I discovered is that there is a possibility that we all can grow and change over years. It may take decades, but there are ways in which we can find common ground. So in the midst of that weekend, I found I was able to have conversations, meaningful conversations, with people I had little in common during high school. But what we discovered is that all of us are human, and we all have concerns for our families and indeed our planet. Regardless of our life situation, if we are determined and committed, we can find common ground. I left my high school reunion saying, you know, these people aren't all bad, that I am not all bad, and that there is a possibility that people can form communities and transform themselves and indeed our world. Yes, hope is something that continue to blossom and grow.
Thank you, Cecil. Love it. Okay, Mary, what did you pick?
I am offering my Hope is a Thing with Feathers in the in honor of the of my Sikh siblings and this concept of Chardi Kala, which is ever rising spirits, even in darkness. And for me, that is a wonderful explanation of Hope is a Thing with Feathers. And aligned with my colleagues, the piece that I want to lift up are the youth-driven and led lawsuits against the United States and states and other companies around climate change. And these lawsuits are starting to get legs and traction. In Montana, they had a victory of their lawsuit. In Oregon, the Juliana versus the United States has continued to go through. They were shut down. They came back. They're on appeal. And there are other places where young activists are taking on the United States and these companies for the harm and the damage that they've caused, not only for us today, but into the future of these young people and beyond. And for me, it is an incredible example. My father, who is an immigrant from China, used to always say to me, you learn the rules of the game. You learn the rules of the game better than anyone else, and then you use them to best the people, the system, at their own game. You know, as the daughter of an immigrant, I've totally been taught that's what you do, and that's what these young people are doing. They are figuring out how to move a legal system. They are figuring out how to navigate the politics, and they are using our own processes and systems to break down and tear down the processes and systems. And I know there's whole conversation about the master's tools are never going to destroy the master's house. I'm okay for some incrementalism. And these young people, in Juliana versus United States, it's 21 children and young adults, teenagers, who are bringing this lawsuit, of course, with the support of adults and et cetera. 21 children are doing what many of us as adults have been unable to do, which is to force a reckoning, or at least a minimally an attention being brought to not only, you know, the climate change issues that we talked about earlier, but also this analysis that says it's not just about today, folks. It's about tomorrow and the day after and the day after. And, you know, supposedly us old people are supposed to understand this generational timeline and the back in times and the forward. They're taking us to town on this, because their understanding of what it means for them and for their children in terms of the climate change and the responsibility for those of us who are adults now is crisp. It's sharp. It's on point. If that's who I'm turning the world over to, or sharing the world with, or leaving to my children, whatever the word is, I'm okay. I'm feeling okay about it. I am hopeful about it.
Thank you for that. Well, I'd like to share my Hope as a Thing with Feathers. I took note of the fact that Illinois was the first state to eliminate cash bail this week, which is really, really huge, because that means that defendants can't be held in jail just because they can't pay. And this is a system that, you know, in some parts of the U.S. has been relaxed somewhat, but Illinois is the first to do away with it entirely. And this is a system, like many interlocking aspects of the criminal justice system, that is disproportionately impacting people of color. They're more likely to be assigned cash bail than white defendants. People of color are. Black men in particular have a really high rate of that. And that is something that cash bail forces, you know, people to take out loans, take out bail bonds and things like that, that drives, you know, low-income families further into poverty. And so now with Illinois being the first to eliminate this, you know, there's maybe some hand-wringing about what's going to happen. Somebody gets charged with a misdemeanor and they're not going to sit in jail until their court date. No, they're not. They don't have to do that anymore. And, you know, laboratories of democracy, states have to try it first. But I think that this is something that other states should look to Illinois and their example of, you know, not even necessarily let's reform the system, let's just stop doing it. Let's stop doing cash bail. You're listening to LTAR Let's Talk About Race. It's our summer 2023 recap show, Drinking Through a Fire Hose.
This is Let's Talk About Race, an award-winning, progressive, intergenerational roundtable of journalists from around the country. We go deep on current events and the role that race plays in our world today. Our show is hosted by Lenita Duke, the award-winning producer of Grassroots News Northwest. Our panel includes Professor Diane Johnson, journalist Althea Billings, talk show host and Reverend Cecil Prescott, and host of The Faith Report, Nia Gray, and proud bureaucrat, Mary Lee. This is Let's Talk About Race.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
You're listening to LTAR Let's Talk About Race. It's our summer 2023 recap show, Drinking Through a Fire Hose.
There are a couple of other things that happened. The Supreme Court gave us a shock. First, Roe versus Wade, but then they, you know, the voters' rights in Alabama, that case. So there's some things going on with the Supreme Court that are certainly noteworthy for the summer.
It's been interesting to me to see how the right just whipsaws back and forth depending on which argument supports their position and point of view. So, you know, we hear a lot about states' rights, don't the overarching reach of the federal government, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have a situation where the state, you know, either itself or the, you know, the overreaching on says, you know, states have got to be held accountable. And then it's back to either we look to the federal government, Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court, we use that argument. And what was the, you know, the original intent of those who framed the Constitution? When it doesn't go against, they go their way, then there are states' rights. You can't tell me what to do. You're not the boss of me. And it's interesting on whatever issue, you know, the two that you just made, where the radical right comes down. And, you know, we've talked a lot about what are our challenges. No one's batting an eyelash about that. They don't consider themselves to have been inconsistent. They don't consider themselves to perhaps be weakening their position or their integrity of their stance or, you know, approach or analysis. It's simply whatever needs to be happened, whatever needs to be done to achieve the ends that they seek is what shall be done. And while I don't advocate for us as, you know, progressives or whoever, quote unquote, we are, we got to look at that and take some lessons about that while we're considering continuing to litmus test ourselves. There's other work that's moving forward that actually is achieving the ends that we hoped we could be achieving. And I think we need to wrestle with that a little bit. So I appreciate you raising it, Professor Johnson.
We have to talk about unions.
Yes.
Such a big union summer. The WGA is on strike. SAG-AFTRA went on strike. We're now speaking, you know, in September, the UAW has gone on strike. LA hotel workers have been on strike. We've got nurses and healthcare workers edging towards the line. Teachers on strike. It's a strike summer. I love a strike summer. We're pleased to see it, especially the way that public perception has shifted, especially with the Hollywood strikes, I think, because they get a lot of attention. And there's very visible ways in which people are either complying with the strike or they're scabbing in opposition to it. But I think that it has changed the conversation somewhat for the average person that, you know, by the numbers is not in a union, maybe doesn't even know anybody that's in a union by them, to see what it looks like, what solidarity looks like, what asking for extremely reasonable and decent things for a worker might look like. And then now I'm speaking a little bit about September, but what the UAW is asking for, which is a 40% raise, really taking aim at those corporate profits. It's not just, you know, the way that the WGA and SAG have framed things, which is the very bare minimum that you certainly can spare. We just need to stay alive. It's instead looking at, well, yes, we want to stay alive. Yes, we want to be able to thrive in these jobs that continue to support us and our families and our towns, but also looking at all of the excess profit that has been made off of these workers' backs as essential workers and saying we deserve a piece of that. That is not something that just gets to go into the CEO's bonus every Christmas or whatever. So it's a strike summer. Exciting things happening in the labor movement. I don't know. Does anybody else want to chime in on that?
Yes, I think it has been so important just to see how workers are organizing throughout the nation, how they are organizing in different places, different industries, in non-traditional workspaces, fast food places, coffee shops, as well as the, you know, industrial workers such as automobile workers. I think that we are in the midst of workers trying to affirm and assert themselves. And as Althea mentioned, in terms of particularly the auto workers, not only wanting, you know, the bare minimum, but critiquing the corporate profits that only a few executives are able to share in, and saying, we are the workers, we deserve it. And you know what? Remember pensions? You know, there are things that we want to reclaim. I am excited by the renewed energy of workers and finding their voice. As a proud son of a union worker who went on the strike lines with my dad, I am so happy.
I forgot to mention, airline pilots were on strike. Airport workers were almost on strike, Professor Johnson.
As Cecil was talking, and also this concept of profit sharing, that they are expanding, not just looking at what is a livable wage or what is my hourly rate going to be, but that I should share in the economic success of this company. Because without these workers, you wouldn't have the economic success. And it made me think that corporations, for a period of time, I don't know how popular it is now, they did have profit sharing programs. Those programs were very small, what employees got in terms in the profit sharing. And I think that targeting and looking at CEOs who walk away with millions and millions of dollars, including bonus dollars and other and stock and all kinds of benefits that are wrapped up in their salaries. And sometimes their companies are failing and they're still getting, you know, the profits and they're still getting the bonuses. So this is a really important point, and I hope that, you know, it just inspires more people to really take a look at it and the lack of equity in pay that exists in these corporations. So I applaud the union's efforts in that regard.
What do you think, Mary?
100% in support. I love the union summer. Let's go, and let's go to union fall and union winter. It makes me reflect that part of what we're seeing here in terms of this dynamic and this movement and aliveness is coming out of the great, great suffering that workers endured during the pandemic. And that's a great, the suffering certainly should be in service to some greater good for the community, not that people deserve to suffer or should have had to suffer to have these conversations. And I appreciate that out of that great suffering, we are now finding this renewed energy and this renewed focus. And I think a crisper and clearer analysis, again, not only on survival and economic survival, but in the sharing of profits and in the distribution, the more equitable distribution of assets, both for families today and also generationally, because we know how important that is for our communities of color. In addition, another item that I was going to raise is the child poverty rates. There have been a number of articles that have come out just recently about the incredible increase, like doubled in a very short period of time, child poverty rates. And the only reason that, you know, research and evaluators can speak to is we eliminated the child tax credits and the other assistance that we sent to families that were proven to reduce exponentially quick amounts of time. The rates of child poverty increased the brain development and the future capacity of children to learn and grow and contribute to society. And yet, even with all of that information, we decided as a country that it wasn't important enough to continue the investment in. And we are now seeing the repercussions of that, which is child poverty is double. And we know that child poverty is going to continue to increase unless we change our understanding and our commitment to investing and using some of these obscene profits that come in a variety of ways to actually better our children, not simply to go into the pockets of a very few who own the companies, who are the stockholders, who do have the means of being able to access the riches of our economy and of this environment. I think we have to look at a number of these economic pieces because there is this sense that the economy is just this unknowable, existing, mysterious thing that we have no impact over. We have no efficacy with as the average person or even the federal government. And yet these examples show us that that's not true. We are making choices, choices based in our true value systems, not our articulated value systems of the sacredness of childhood, the formation of the quote unquote American family as being the bedrock. It's capitalism, greed, and profits into the hands of a few that actually is the bedrock of this country and the way in which we approach our investments. So the love the union piece of it, support it. Again, this analysis of it coming out of the suffering of the pandemic. And again, not that we're out of the pandemic. We're probably into our next cycle now. What is it, cycle 5 or 6? But the continuing suffering of the experience of the pandemic and other challenges are absolutely tied to this economic analysis. And our children are suffering. Once they suffered before, there was a little bit of light, and they're suffering again now.
So rarely is there actually such a clear cause and effect in public policy. To be able to see that here's what's happened, here's what we did, it worked, we undid it, it stopped working. Very rarely do you get to see that. And I think, you know, like Mary's saying, this provokes so many important economic conversations that I think it's very easy to stray away from, especially with the unionizing and things like that. I've had conversations with some of the young people in my life who maybe this is like the first time that they've really encountered this kind of issue. And they're coming to me like, well, why should someone who works at a bookstore make $20 an hour? It's like, great question. Why do you look down on X type of work? Why? What is, you know, and analyzing those values along with it, because we do put a dollar amount of what work is worth without necessarily considering the scope of there is a live human person doing a thing, and that person needs to be alive. There was a statistic that came out over the summer that analyzed that if the minimum wage nationwide, which mind you is $7.25 an hour, I believe, if it had kept pace with inflation and importantly, productivity, inflation and productivity, it would be $26 an hour. I don't make that now. That is something that sounds extremely high. And I, you know, live in an urban area that generally has higher minimum wages. And I think, especially thinking about it in terms of productivity, all that is being created and where is it going, that $26 an hour is something that so few can actually claim for themselves is another important point of this.
You're listening to Let's Talk About Race, internationally awarded Best Audio Podcast and Best Audio Production at the Swedish International Film Festival, Eddie Play International Film Festival in France, Echo Nation Audio and Film Festival in Greater Manchester, England, Bright International Film Festival in London, and at the Fourth Dimension Independent Film Festival in Bali, Indonesia. Let's Talk About Race is an intergenerational roundtable discussion of independent journalists who engage in rigorous conversations and analysis of news coverage regarding the role race plays in politics, government, the economy, education, and health. And now, back to our show.
Previously on Let's Talk About Race, LTAR discusses gun violence in America, as American as cherry pie.
I want to talk about the underpinnings of this epidemic and go way, way back. And I want to go back and say that I believe this epidemic started with the theft of the land from indigenous people and the theft from the land of its resources and attributes from the enslavement of Africans. State-sanctioned enforcement of these two economic realities through the use of violence represented by gun. And if we can understand who had them, who did not, who got to use them, who did not. The origins of police as the vigilante groups to return enslaved people to the enslavers. That, I think, is the origins of this. And it is over these, the years of this country has been co-opted into a white supremacy culture that uses this agenda against Black and Indigenous people of color, women, domestic violence, the others, and of which we all are.
I think it's important to acknowledge that the gun violence, the violent epidemic that we are experiencing now, while it is horrible, it is based on the legacy of violence in this nation. We all recognize and remember the wise observation of, I believe, H. Rapp Brown, who says violence is American as cherry pie. And I think if we look at the history of this nation, it is rooted in violence and oppression of peoples. From the initial entry of European invaders into this nation, where they massacre indigenous people, to the importation of Africans into this nation, through the continued effort to uplift the powerful, violence is part of who we are. And to offer a different perspective is to go against the natural grain of our society.
To truly look at the issue is to be overwhelmed. To understand it is to be bombarded with the enormity of it all, right? But the first word in gun violence is gun. That has to be a big part of it. And we are in a unique society that wants to waffle on that topic. In 23 states, I believe, brass knuckles are banned. We can ban weapons. That's allowed. Switchblades, a lot of places are banned. You know, you can't go into a sporting arena with certain things on your person. It is not unreasonable that living in a society, there are certain things we're not going to do so that we can all get along. And the underpinnings of gun violence are, of course, what my fellow panelists have pointed out. This legacy of white supremacist, male-dominated violence that has been enacted towards all peoples in our society, and including to other white men. A lot of victims of gun violence are white men. A lot of perpetrators of gun violence are white men. The guns play a big part in it. They're very, very lethal.
The common thread is gender in terms of between and among perpetrators. Men are by far and away the ones who are utilizing this tool called a gun in these mass shootings. I think when we understand or look at the statistics for suicide and for accidental shooting and the shooting of children, that dynamic changes a little bit. However, when we are talking about these mass events, we're talking about men, and we're talking predominantly, I'm going to say it, white men. The common thread, that's not exclusive, I'm very much aware of that. The common threads are what we were just talking about in the last question, which is economics and racism on white supremacy culture. And I want to be super clear that my vision of freedom and equity and equality for women, for people of color, for all sorts of different folks is not that we can get to take up the tools of the oppressor and use them against ourselves. That is not my idea of liberty. That is not my idea of freedom. That is not my idea of having arrived in terms of full access to and benefit from the benefits of the society and culture. It's a pretty simple through line for me. It's based in gender. It's based in misogyny. It's based in racism. And in the end, it's based in economics. And once we understand that, I hope it becomes easier to see where we might take half measures to try to address some of what we're seeing here and hopefully prevent.
You can look at other developed nations in the world and compare the number of gun deaths. And there's a big disparity there, even if you want to go per capita. They do not have the access to guns that Americans have. And what has the access to guns gotten us, aside from living in terror?
You know, whenever there's a mass shooting or whenever there is terrible activity or terrible crime, we often see commentators come and pontificate about why this has happened, whether it's social, what's wrong with our society, what's wrong with our education system, what's wrong with our families. And among the common threads, I think of perpetrators, they all have access to guns. Violence did not begin with guns and will not end with the elimination of guns. What's common among all the common thread we see is at least access to guns, whether it is, you know, someone who had training in the military or whether it's someone who had access to their parents' locked up gun closet, whether it is someone who was able to go into the corner gun store and buy a gun, or someone who had access from a friend or stole a gun. What is common is the numbers of guns in our society. In the United States, where there are more guns than there are individuals, I think that is a problem, and that we must recognize that our society is not so unique than other society, and that the level of gun violence is so much higher in this nation than in about any other nation. So we have to say, what is wrong with our nation that we have access to so many guns? And, you know, certainly, as I noted, that guns and violence is part of our nation's history and is part of our, some might say, our DNA. But I think it's also the possibility that we can resist that, and we do not have to say, well, it has always been and so it will always be.
These personal grievances or workplace grievances or something that was a specific challenge that has driven people to do such a heinous act, then the question becomes, we don't all go out and shoot people when we get divorced or we get demoted or we lose a job. So what is it? What is that factor that's different here and that puts a gun in the hand of a person and that's the decision that they make?
We all as humans are able to experience rage and depression and grief and have challenges with our mental health, all the feels. That is not, from my perspective, what's wrong with this situation. What is going wrong in this situation is that when we have all these feels, we have way too easy access to guns that have such an incredible lethality to them. So again, this common sense piece of, you know, that old tried thing like guns don't kill people, people kill people. Well, people have those feelings. I can completely agree with that. We all experiencing these ups and downs of life. However, when certain individuals have these feelings, they have way too easy access to guns, and guns are so lethal.
How do we meet challenges? How do we engage with one another? How do we resist so much in ways that are life-affirming rather than life-denying? It's a hard, difficult question. And I think that we will begin to answer that when we begin to ask hard questions about who we are and not who we think we are.
The feeling of helplessness. What can, what would this feeling of complete inadequacy to have any impact or to be able to understand enough to be able to have impact? And I think we've got to fight against that as hard as we can. because it plays into the dynamic of we cannot know, we cannot understand, thus we can do nothing. And in the face, in the vacuum of doing nothing, these kind of horrific acts of violence continue to move forward. And I feel almost like common sense might drive us or show us a pathway towards some type of action. And I am a person who believes that even incrementalism has its role, has its moment. And if we could just make things a little bit better, maybe it's not the universal panacea, but if we could just make things a little less worse, harm reduction, could we practice our harm reduction in this movement?
Those were excerpts from our show, Let's Talk About Race, Gun Violence in America, as American as Cherry Pie. Thanks for taking a look back with us. All of our previous episodes can be found online by searching Let's Talk About Race, LTAR, and listen to us regularly on your local community radio station.
This is Let's Talk About Race, an award-winning, progressive, intergenerational roundtable of journalists from around the country. We go deep on current events and the role that race plays in our world today. Our show is hosted by Lenita Duke, the award-winning producer of Grassroots News Northwest. Our panel includes Professor Diane Johnson, journalist Althea Billings, talk show host and Reverend Cecil Prescott, and host of The Faith Report, Nia Gray, and proud bureaucrat, Mary Lee. This is Let's Talk About Race.
Come on.
Let's talk about race. Baby. Let's talk about you and me. Let's talk about all the good things and the bad things that make me. Let's talk about
race.
Let's talk about
race.
Talk about
race.
Previously on Let's Talk About Race.
Home is where the violence is. Domestic violence in America. The most dangerous time in a relationship is when a woman wants to leave. Half of women who die by homicide in America are killed by an intimate partner or a family member. This is a pandemic within a pandemic.
Women would leave if they could leave, but they have no place to go.
In essence, at that moment in time, the violence that has been so effective for the abuser to be using against his victim has failed, because the evidence of an autonomy or self-determination or an ability to say, nope, I actually am worth it, I actually can move, I actually shall move, is almost pushing it in the face of the abuser that your abuse has failed. Your attempt to control this person has failed to the extent that they are contemplating or struggling or trying or actually leaving you. And that is part of why I think it's a particularly dangerous time. Because we're not looking at root causes, we are not able to understand what it would take to change and end this kind of violence. Heterosexual marriage was an institution of property, was an institution of economics, and was an institution by the means of which men controlled production up until including children. So it's an economic imperative that there be this, you know, contract. I mean, women were chattel to be brought into a relationship and a dowry paid. I mean, if you look at all of these trappings of heterosexual marriage and that institution, it was economics.
The conversation is focused on the woman and not the man. What is wrong in this culture that we produce men who are violent?
I know plenty of men who really revere their mothers. They revere their mothers, but not in their capacity as women, but as someone who provides for them and loves them unconditionally. And it kind of plays into this Madonna horror complex, where because the mother is a non-sexual figure in one's life, there is a special reverence for that. And when you're encountering women elsewhere out in the world and sex and sexuality is introduced, there's a framework of understanding that divides women's humanity into Madonnas and whores. And Madonnas are to be respected and whores are not worth it.
it prevents men in many ways from seeing the complex human person, the humanity of the women in their life, and that the cycle continues because they can never find a woman who is their mother, who will unconditionally love them and serve them in all of the ways that a parent does, because that's a parent. That's not an adult romantic relationship. It's very troubling, but it is something that can be pieced apart if you're interested in doing the work. There was a question posed in some of the reading that I did about this, was thinking about the people in your life, thinking about the women in your life, thinking about your partners. What is it that you like about them that has nothing to do with the ways in which they serve you? And that isn't to say, you know, someone who's generous or a good listener shouldn't be valued for those things, but understanding what is it about the people in my life, and not to say that you should cut anybody out for any of those things, but to understand somebody complexly, what is it that is inherent about them that I enjoy aside from they're a great cook, or they always listen to my problems, or they pay for a bunch of stuff that I'm really interested in doing, or any number of things like that, I think is an interesting place to start in figuring out what is it that I really value in somebody else that doesn't have to do with the ways that they are serving me.
That was an excerpt of our episode, Let's Talk About Race, The Second Pandemic, Domestic Violence in America. All of our back episodes can be found on SoundCloud by searching Let's Talk About Race, LTAR.
Well, that's our show for today. Thank you so much for listening to Let's Talk About Race. I like to end the show by saying every day and in every way, we hope you agitate for social change. Thank you for listening.
For more information on Let's Talk About Race, visit us on social media. We're on Facebook at Let's Talk Race 1, or check us out on Instagram at LTAR Show or www.letstalkrace.net.
The following program has been produced by
Grassroot News Northwest. Catch previous episodes on Apple Podcasts or SoundCloud under LTAR or Let's Talk About Race. Thank you for listening.
Side. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, listener-supported community radio.
You are listening to KBOO Community Radio, and we're in the middle of our fall membership drive. Help us meet our $55,000 goal by making a contribution today. KBOO's organic, free-range, independent programming is only possible with your support. Give now at kboo.fm/give. You can also donate by texting the word KBOO to 44321 or by mailing a check to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. Our members continue to fertilize community radio every time they give.
I'm Doug McVeigh, host of Free Culture Radio. Every month, we bring you 30 minutes of news.